Welcome to episode 133 of the Sports Geek Podcast. On this week's episode, I chat with Chris Harris from Arsenal.
Welcome to the Sports Geek Podcast, the podcast built for sports digital and sports business professionals.
And now, here's your host, who's changed the Sports Geek Twitter handle three times, Sean Callanan.
Thanks, DJ Joel. Yes, I have changed the Sports Geek Twitter handle three times. Initially, when Sports Geek wasn't available, it was underscore Sports Geek underscore worst handle ever. Once I decided that was a terrible handle, I went to Sports Geek HQ, which I had for a long while until luckily enough I went over to Twitter and caught up with Laura King at Twitter, and she said, "Oh, do you want Sports Geek as a handle? I'll check if it's available." And luckily enough, it was. So that's how I eventually got Sports Geek as a Twitter handle. My name is Sean Callanan. I'm the man behind Sports Geek. My Twitter handle is at Sean Callanan. And that's why I was always using my handle first and set up the Sports Geek Twitter handle as a secondary thing when I finally figured out to start up Sports Geek way back in 2009. That makes it 8 years ago. Wow. And you're listening to the Sports Geek Podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or my favourite podcasting app, Pocket Casts. So this episode, I catch up with Chris Harris from Arsenal. And you know what's been the amazing thing about doing this podcast is, one, the people that I've been able to meet either via the podcast and via doing things like doing conferences like Seek Conference and Money in Sport and those kind of things and meeting people in real life, but also the connections that I've made via social, but also the connections I'm now making in the sports business Slack community. So Chris Harris runs all things, he's managing editor digital at Arsenal, and we actually connected. We'd connected on Twitter and LinkedIn, and then Chris joined up the sports business Slack community, and that's sort of how we sort of started going backwards and forwards about, hey, let's have a chat on the podcast. So I think I said it earlier in previous podcasts, but sports biz Slack community has been one of the big successes for mine in developing that community. There's now over 700 sports executives across multiple continents. I think the last check was 17, 18 different time zones. You can sign up and join up. You're a listener, so you qualify. You work in the sports business. Simply go to sportsgeekhq.com/slack. I'd really love, one of the early goals for this year is to get that community to 1,000 people, because, again, the conversations and the sharing that's happening in there has been, you know, I'm finding great benefit from it, and I'm also hearing the same from people in the community. There's channels around digital, a really vibrant esports channel. There's ones people sharing latest sponsorship activations, some conversation on what's happening in the general media. These are all channels, and then the other part which I'm finding really valuable is the IRL. In real life, I think it's a really big and important component of any digital community. So we've even got an in real life channel. And just recently, I connected a couple of sports biz slackers at CES that were both going to be there that hadn't met, but they were both in the community. So if you're not involved yet, if you haven't signed up, please take the time. It's mobile responsive. sportsgeekhq.com/slack. You sign up, you get in. And if you haven't been using it, I strongly suggest have Slack on your phone and just make it your coffee ritual. Just quickly scan over it, see what's being shared, add a reaction or two to a few of the posts, and after a while, you'll get more and more benefit from it. It's pretty much, you know, the effort you put in will be the reward you get out. Which is, you know, a common theme at the start of the year is everyone starts to try to get fit and those kind of things. Well, I'm saying it, get sports biz Slack fit. So let's get into the interview I had with Chris. I had this interview late 2016, but we chatted about all things Arsenal and digital and the different different platforms that are working for Arsenal. So here's my chat with Chris Harris. Very happy to welcome Chris Harris, Managing Editor for Digital for Arsenal, to the Sports Geek Podcast. Welcome.
Sean, hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to always chat with someone in the middle of a season just recently, the round of 16 for champions, and Arsenal draws Bayern again. It's like death and taxes. Champions League round of 16. Arsenal will play Bayern Munich. What's the your content team and your digital team doing behind the scenes, waiting for that draw and sort of running out all the potential options that might come out? What are you doing behind the scenes while something like the Champions League draw is happening?
Well, the first thing to say, Sean, is that there was an almighty groan that went up in the office when this rule was made, because, of course, we finished first this year. And as the manager, Arsene Wenger, said, you don't feel guilty when you finish first. But, of course, we can feel a bit aggrieved to get Bayern again. Having said that, I think we're a better team than when we last played them. Hopefully they're not as strong as they were when we last played them. But, yeah, we get prepared. We have all sorts of content ready for whichever team we're going to play. And Bayern are very prolific on social. They have a good personality on Twitter, so we'll probably do some stuff with them on there. But I think it was about acknowledging the draw, and we've got a game tonight against Everton, which is going to date this podcast, I guess. But we'll think more about the game when we get closer to it. But yeah, there was a big groan, I can tell you that much.
And did you get that same groan? Like, it's really good. You can get the pulse of the fan, you know, from social, whether it's, you know, the reaction on Facebook or what they're saying on Twitter. Was it effectively a collective groan from the fans of Arsenal as well?
It really was. Just the responses to our original tweet on the news, there were some of the best GIFs you'll see, you know, people just head in hands. But I think it just goes globally. Arsenal fans thought they were going to get an easier draw this time. But you know what they say, you've got to beat the big teams to win it.
Yep. So is there any particular focus or thing that you're really concentrating on this year from a digital point of view, from what you're doing with Arsenal?
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, I think our tone has changed a lot over the last 6 months or so. We are much more interactive with our fans. International is a big thing for us. I think that's where the growth is, and we're only really scratching the surface internationally. So that's a big thing for this season as well.
And so when you're saying you're doing that interaction piece, that's a really hard piece to do with a really large fan base. So how do you do that without, you know, wearing out the thumbs of the person that's behind the different accounts? And is there a particular platform that you're doing more of the interacting on?
I think Facebook and Twitter most of all. I think interaction and tone are something where when you go onto social as a club, first of all, you've got to get that buy-in from the higher echelons of the club that it's a good idea. Of course, we've got past that now, as so many teams have. But I think when you start out, there's this level of this caution, this slight anxiety where you are kind of naturally conservative, naturally quite aloof with your interaction and your tone. I sometimes use the example of how town criers used to be spokesmen for the king, and they'd ring their bell and open their scroll and they'd read the news, and then they'd just disappear and they'd leave it for the people to digest. And it was a very one-way conversation back then. It was a very one-way conversation with us and our fans for a long time as well. But these days, you know, we stick around, have a conversation. We ask the fans what they think. You've got to give them a platform, and you know, it's social media, so we try and be as social as we can. And that can work in terms of, you know, the entire fan base. You could be putting something out and trying to get some feedback on this game was, you know, describe it in one word. Or also that micro engagement, if you just need to get into someone and say, well, this is why this particular video didn't appear on this Facebook clip. You've got to show you're listening. I think that's the bottom line.
So it is a bit more of the listening side, but then also just dipping your toe in the backwards and forwards and a bit of that banter that we're seeing at club level, but also with the fans, to sort of so they feel they get that little digital pat on the back, so to speak, that they're feeling heard by the club.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think if you want to build that engaged audience, you know, you need that empathy, you need that kind of human connection. And we have those restrictions because we're club media, so we can't get that close to our fans. but we have to act like a club, we have to think like a fan, we have to humanize ourselves, and we've done that a lot in the last 6 months.
And I do think, you know, if I look at the US market and the European and English market, I think the English market did take on the voice that that very much that town crier role, or even the extension of the coach, you know, of Arsene Wenger, and sort of saying, we're sort of tweeting in that manner to a certain degree and keeping that same tone. Whereas I think in the US, they've had a bit more playful backwards and forwards. You know, we've got the example with the LA Kings and now Dwayne's in Portland and having that banter, the way the NBA does. And sort of they've disconnected that from the coaching staff type of persona. And I am seeing, you know, I guess things loosen up in Europe. Now that, you know, that fear of, oh, if we tweet something, the fans will take it on board as upper management are saying it. And now they just sort of know that it's a very much a disposable form and more in the banter side than in the pure comms, press release type of communications.
Yeah, I think that's true. We often get accused, Sean, of having a new admin on various platforms. It's actually the same team, just with more freedom. Yep. And I think you bring up the US sports there. It's true to say, I think a lot of teams over here are inspired by the NBA, for example. That's always felt to me a more natural environment for that kind of friendly rivalries. You see that in their output as well. I remember one, I think it was the Panthers, when they lost to the Broncos, and they said it's an honor to face the best. And you know, that's a great way to behave on social. There was a time when I thought, you know, maybe I still do to a point, if we did that at Arsenal, I can imagine that the reaction would be, you know, quite negative, because I think it's more tribal over here. Maybe it's a more tribal kind of element, and those conversations with other teams, they can look a bit strained, they can look a bit contrived. But I think if you give your team the freedom to be themselves a bit more, especially if they're fans of the club and they think like a fan, then I think you get a lot more, you get those conversations, they look more natural. The other way I think it's worked for us is that we've changed our structure a bit in terms of, we now have social ownership. So I think you used to have a website first and then, okay, here's the story. What can we do? Let's put something on Twitter. Let's put something on Facebook, Instagram, and now, of course, a bit on Snapchat as well. I think now we've gone the other way around. So we have people who are effectively leads for different channels. If it's channel focused and they're thinking, okay, how can this work on Facebook? What is this audience going to need? And then it's not an afterthought. It's very much the first thing they think of.
Okay, so you've really gone to that point where someone is the lead on Facebook. So they're optimizing the content for that platform, optimizing the community management and the interaction for that platform. And then someone else is doing something similar, but with Twitter or Instagram, and it sort of gives them that focus. They get to dive into all the crevices and the different nuances for those platforms and try to find what works for you.
Yeah, that's true. And I think what that does, Sean, is that gives you a consistent tone across those channels. If you have here's a story, let's kind of spread it everywhere, and you have maybe a team of four or five journalists, editors doing that, you don't get that consistent tone. I think if you have someone who's kind of taking responsibility for Facebook, for example, you're going to get that person's tone of voice. And so if someone does step in, at least they know the kind of tone that they need to take. They've got to follow the line that the guys have led.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really important, because the easiest thing, and you know, you do see teams do it, is we've got something coming out and it just gets blasted on all the different channels. Yeah, the images might be resized and things like that, but it's really, there's a lot of sameness. Whereas if you, you've got to have that individuality and a little bit different on the different platforms, otherwise there's no real benefit for fans to follow you on all these different accounts, because if they go, oh well, I saw it on Facebook, oh there's the Instagram version of it, oh there's the tweet version of it, you want to have a bit of that variability around each platform.
Yeah, I agree. And I think what happens there also, Sean, is that you give the freedom to an individual to be a bit more personable, and they end up being a lot braver as well. So you have the parameters of, okay, this is club media, we can't go too far, can't cross that line. But at the same time, you know, you can be braver in terms of, you can reflect how a fan is feeling during a game. You know, you can use GIFs instead of obsessing over copy, which we all do in this industry. I mean, you would have done this a million times yourself, but you're faced with a post. What are you going to say? And pitching that copy is so important. And often in the past, I think we've been a little bit stifled by the fact that, you know, we're nervous about what we're going to put out there. One of the great things about GIFs is now you can convey those emotions without having to use copy, because if you're obsessing over copy and you're reaching for it, you know, if you're straining, then there's probably an issue with it.
Yep. Now, my best tip for copy is cut it in half. Less is more when you're getting into that space. There's such a competition now, both, you know, locally in England for football fans, but Arsenal fans in particular, because you've got so many different competitors. You know, you are Arsenal media, and you're competing against all these media giants as well as internationally. How do you try to get, you know, you're fighting for the attention of Arsenal fans with there's so much content out there. How do you try to cut through that to say, one, we are the club source, but we are worthy of your attention?
Yeah, I think being the official source helps, especially when it comes to transfers, team news, that kind of thing. But I think it's about just owning those moments. You know, how do we get an emotional response to the content we make, and when do we put it out there? Is it authentic? Is it well-timed? Is it unique? And I think as club media, of course, we're restricted by rights. We have to have that audience awareness. You know, that's critical. When have we got the captive audience? When and where are they consuming Arsenal content, and can they consume it with us? So if you take a live match, okay, while the game is on, okay, we're not silly enough to think they're not following it on TV. But as soon as that final whistle goes, you know, that's often our time. You know, that's broadcasters go off to the adverts. We can take you back into the stadium with our cameras on your second screen. You know, you might not want to watch the analysis on TV. You might not want to watch a pretty dull one-to-one reaction interview. But we can show a footage. A good example recently, Sean, was we had Mesut Ozil after a good win over Chelsea. He took his shirt off, threw it to a kid in the crowd, and the emotion on this kid's face, you know, it's just incredible. It ticked every box. You had a big win, you had a star player, you had an emotional fan. It was our second most viewed Facebook video of all time. And that's it. You know, you grab people's attention, you know where the audience is, and you realize, when can we capitalize? And so you prepare for those moments, you plan, and having cameras in the right place and the right staff to react to those moments, now that's paramount for us.
I think the concept of when is really important, because you're right. If you're doing your job right, and yes, there is, you know, there is a need for in-game commentary to a certain degree, but you know, if your fans are in, they're watching it on the main screen. They're watching either in the stadium or they're watching it on a TV. But it's when the TV cameras go away that, you know, that post-match analysis, the snippets, the interviews that you're not getting in other places, that are more valuable to those fans, because that's where they go next. They go, okay, the game's over. Now I want, you know, everyone else has dried up. All the other content's gone. I know my team will have more. So it's really important to have that as a plan post-match, or, you know, the content for the next day when the 24-hour news cycle is past and traditional outlets aren't reporting anything, but your fans, they still want more. The appetite for content just seems to keep growing and growing.
Exactly, and if you can catch them at the right time, then that's when you can get some big wins. The other thing, Sean, of course, is as club media, you get the access to the players that others don't get. And for all that the media landscape is transformed, I've been at Arsenal for 14 years, and that's quite alarming in one sense that you're at the same place. But at the same time, because things have changed so much in the media, it feels like a procession of different jobs. But one thing that stays consistent throughout all of that is storytelling. And if you've got access to players and you can tell those stories, then that's another way to get to your fans and get that, again, the empathy, that human connection we talked about.
And how are you finding, especially over your time at Arsenal, how much is the athlete becoming savvier and understanding
that that's part of the puzzle now, and that's how they become bigger brands. If they become potentially more accessible, or they become good at sharing their personality and sharing their stories, and them seeing that that upside, whether it be with club media or even just traditional media, to go, you know, it's a real big opportunity that the players with the biggest personalities can potentially be as big, or if not more popular, than some of the players with actually more talent.
Yeah, well, I've been here long enough to know that the previous generation, obviously like ourselves, we didn't grow up with this. But for the new generation, it's a reflex action. And I think it's a symbiotic relationship between the players we have and club media as well. We know that they can be utterly authentic because they're the players, their personality, if they do it right, can completely shine through. But for us, you know, we can work with them, we can help them, we can provide them with footage. But from a club point of view, we need to use the players properly. You know, there's no point sitting down and doing a 10-minute piece on the next game. You know, the players didn't grow up thinking, okay, I think I really want to talk about the Everton away for 10 minutes and talk about their strikers and defenders. You want to talk to them about things that they are happy to talk about. You know, you want to find out, who are the characters? What's the conflict? What have their struggles been? When we talk about international fans as well, we hear more and more, some of our Indian fans are really keen to hear those stories about how players overcome odds. So we can help the players tell those stories. And as I say, it's a symbiotic relationship. We're getting the best out of them and they can get the best out of us.
And from your point of view, how do you balance the seesaw that is social versus website and web traffic on, you know, how much is we want to be leaning into these platforms, whether it be Facebook or Instagram or Twitter or Snapchat, and growing these audiences, engaging these audiences, to also go back to, you know, what was your original job around creating content for the website and driving traffic and getting that balance? How do you juggle that, weigh that up on what's a pure social play, a pure native play type of thing to a let's get them to the website, because that's still where, you know, a lot of our revenue and activation sort of happens back on the website.
Yeah, I think like a lot of teams, you know, the overarching strategy is pretty traditional. It's reach, engage, monetize, as it has been for so long. I guess my team, my department, we build those big social followings and then we put them in front of partners. You know, we want to get them back to our website. We have digital membership there. So for us, it's about broadening the audience, building the engaged audience. You know, that's one of the reasons for the change of tone, the change of tactics, is because those vanity figures, you know, used to be all well and good, and being the first Premier League club to 8 million on Twitter and what have you is great. But if those fans aren't engaged, then they're not going to engage when we put them into the website as well.
Yep. And from a monetized point of view, you've got your digital membership as a product. I spoke with Joe Gottfried at Maple Leaf Sports, who sort of sits in that between the commercial team and the digital team. How much of your work is working with the sponsorship guys and seeing how they can best integrate offerings to sponsors around digital, or is that sort of a different department? How does that work in the Arsenal space?
That's a different department from me. I mean, I think we build those big engaged audiences, which obviously we can then put in front of partners. I think what has changed, especially in recent years, is the digital team are in those conversations a lot earlier. You know, that's part of the digital inventory now is part of the discussion when a partner comes on board. And I think for a number of years, and I think a lot of teams will say this, you want to get your ideas in at the start of the process because you consider yourself to be, you know, I suppose the experts in terms of content creation. And the questions are, do brands know what they want? What does success look like for them? You know, I think if we can be in those conversations earlier, then we can help them and they can help us.
And it's a really good point, because it's a problem or an issue that I'm always dealing with. And it does work differently for different teams, and that's why I mentioned Joe, because it's a really unique role that he sort of sits in between the two. But the way you just described it, of, you know, for it, getting digital further in earlier on those commercial discussions, because one, you know the content that works, and you know the fan base better than anybody, You know what they like, what they're going to engage with, you know, where the certain types of fans live. And that's really valuable from a commercial point of view. And it's just more, you know, as the sponsors start leaning more into digital, that integration is going to become more and more important.
Yeah, and I think partners see that digital adds value. You know, we can extend the partner value through our content. And from our point of view, if we have a certain tone, we have a certain appeal to fans, then that branded content has got to fit that tone because, you know, Sean, audiences, they're smarter than ever. They'll see a brand ad a mile away. You know, you've got to promote content that they feel invested in. And if you don't do that, you're not really showing respect for the audience. So that sits slightly askew with all the rest of the stuff you're putting out, which does have that empathy and that connection.
You spoke a little bit before about international and the growth that's in that space. Is there a particular, because it's very hard to say, tackle international growth and just sort of say that's everywhere but here. Are you doing it as a region by region thing to say we're doing this in, you know, in this particular region with these platforms with this particular content? What is the strategy around international?
Well, I think, I mean, the stat that stood out for me this year after a bit of research over the summer was that I think 96% of our Facebook audience are not in the UK. But up until the end of last season, I think it was around 92% of our Facebook posts were global. You know, we had this kind of one size fits all approach, which was, you know, really outdated. And so, you know, that has to change. That has to change. In terms of which territories, well, I suppose the club, there's different strands to this. The club has strategic markets that we obviously follow, the likes of China, for example. But then I guess a lot of clubs will have their tactical countries where they have a big fan base or there's a big Premier League following. We have tactical languages in terms of maybe Spanish. Arabic's a good example. We signed an Egyptian player, Mohamed El Neni, back in January. And so that opened up a whole new market for us. So we support the club in those real strategy regions, but those tactical regions and languages where we can build a big social following, that's something which can then be leveraged by our commercial team. And I think beyond that, that's you've got to go beyond just having a player and saying, right, we've signed a player who speaks Arabic. Let's speak to some Arabic fans. That's a good start, but that's not enough. You know, you first of all, there's a language barrier, there's a tone barrier. You know, you can't just speak the language. You've got to speak the language, if you know what I mean. You've got to speak in the way that they expect to be spoken to. And beyond that, of course, you can't rely on a player staying at a club for, you know, a huge length of time. Those days are mainly gone. You've got to get enough humanizing storytelling, history content. So a fan in, say, Egypt will fall in love with Arsenal because it's Arsenal, not just because Mohamed El Neni plays with them. So if a player ever leaves, we still have the fan.
Yep. And that's the thing. You want to sort of convert those fans from following the player to following the club.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, good storytelling, we talked about it earlier, it works in any language, and we've got so many good stories to tell. You know, if you go through the whole squad, you have those conflicts, you have those characters. We did a nice piece with our centre-back, Gabriel, about his upbringing in Brazil. He had a really difficult upbringing. And just showing that human side of the players, one player may be a gateway to a club for a fan anywhere in the world, but if they start hearing and seeing more of those human stories, then they start to get the emotional connection with the club a bit more.
I wanted to ask you about Snapchat and Instagram. They seem to be in a copy war, probably more so Instagram than Snapchat, and they seem to be blending into almost the same product in some instance, or at least the same feature set, if not the same product. What are you seeing? What's working for you? What are you testing in the two different platforms from an Arsenal point of view?
Well, Instagram is big for us. We've done very well on Twitter over the years, but I mean, you'll know that the growth on Instagram is, I think, something like 4 or 5 times the growth on Twitter. I think we are just about to pass our Twitter number on Instagram, which, you know, you wouldn't have predicted a few years ago.
Yep.
In terms of stories, That's a difficult one. We've dipped our toe in the water there a little bit. There's a resource issue here. I think a lot of teams will say the same. You've got to think about who have I got working on a match day. You've got to dedicate someone to do it properly. I think there's no point, you know, mucking around, fiddling around the edges with something like Instagram stories. You can't just have someone doing it as 10% of their match day job. It's got to be someone who comes in and really owns it, whether it's an influencer, whether it's a member of staff. You've got to really own that and do it properly. So at the moment, we're kind of sticking with our Snapchat story, because we have Instagram on a match day. We have, you know, we have filters on our images for matches. We have some really nice graphics and animation, emotion graphics on there. So stories has been kind of sidelined because we're thinking, no, let's do everything properly rather than doing it half baked. As for Snapchat, I think that we're up about 350,000 followers on there now. That's quite a big increase, about 20-25% from back end of last season. And it's mainly match day stories. It's mainly events. But I think what we've also noticed on Snapchat is that the player takeovers, they do really, really well. It's that personality piece again, Sean. You know, if you put the phone into the hands of someone like Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, Danny Welbeck, Hector Bellerin, suddenly they'll come alive. And it's that raw, less polished, that exclusive kind of behind the scenes. It's it's about tone, and it's completely authentic, and that works really well. The problem, of course, you have is that it's an engagement play, but it's a demographic we're not reaching, and you've got to go where your fans are.
Yep. And are you finding, obviously, you know, you hand over a Snapchat account to a player and they take it to like a duck to water because they're using it. Are you seeing many of your players starting to publicly Snapchat and share their day in the Snapchat space?
Not too much. I think we talked about that symbiotic relationship between club media and players, and a nice example from recently, our Spanish right back Hector Bellerin, we announced his new contract with a Facebook Live. We had a kind of an empty room. I'm not sure if you saw it, but we kind of set up the interview room as we would for a normal interview. And then he came in at the end, sat down, did his message, announced that he'd signed a new deal. So a nice innovative way to announce a contract. And at the end of that, his message was, okay, I'm going to be sharing some more of this on my Snapchat story. So he's quite active on there. And again, as I guess you find at a lot of places, some of the players buy into it and they're naturals on it. And some of them, perhaps the older players, they kind of leave it alone.
Yeah, I mean, it's been funny. I've done a few group athlete training sessions over the years. And every time I poll them all, what platform are they using and what platform are they on? The last couple of ones that I've done, they're very much saying, yes, they're either on Twitter or becoming more dormant. The troll issue is a bit of an issue there. They're all using Instagram. They love Instagram. It's, you know, again, it's easy. You can put up a photo. You don't have to look at all the mentions. They were all on Snapchat, but not many of them. They were using it, so they were using it to snap and message with their friends, but not many of them were publicly saying, this is my Snapchat account. And I think that is something that will probably grow. They will start using it. You know, we're seeing a few athletes try using it and that kind of thing. And again, I think it's that bit of the one-way nature. They get to control the flow of the content backwards and forwards and how much they engage. I think it's really appealing to players potentially. And so it'll be interesting to see how that sort of develops over the next 12 to 18 months. Whether Insta or Snapchat sort of wins that battle for the athlete on that story side of things.
I think what Snapchat has, though, there's this incredible innovation. I mean, every single time you think, they're going to struggle here because they're just going to be bullied by someone stealing their ideas. They come up with something else, creative, always engaging. So, you know, I think they're going to do quite well.
That's the thing. There's people saying, Snapchat's done it. There goes the neighbourhood. No, Snapchat won't have it because Instagram's now doing this. But to mine, you take it the reverse way. Instagram is teaching everyone how Snapchat works, and the fact it's a story and it's only there for 24 hours, then people get on Snapchat and they understand what the product is now. So it's going to be an interesting battle to see how it goes. But I do agree the resourcing thing of how do we do a Snapchat story and how do we do an Instagram story justice? Because it still requires someone to be on the on the phone and out there taking that message and having that eye for a story, that, yeah, if you just say, oh, we'll do the same story on both, then, again, you're back in that same situation of not serving the platforms sufficiently.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think it's a general theme here at Arsenal that, you know, we have to be present on a number of platforms, but it's always more important to do it well than to do it first. Yeah. And I think if you look forward to, say, VR becoming more prevalent, AR as well, and of course, we've talked about Snapchat and Instagram stories, do it properly. Don't just do it for the sake of it. It's got to be, especially if it's the first experience on that platform, if we talk about VR, it's got to be that immersive experience. And you can't just, again, don't do it half-baked. You've got to do it well because people will come back.
Yeah, and that's I think that's something that when I spoke to your former colleague, you know, Rich, in his discussions, you know, it was always let's get it right first rather than being first. Like, it's much better exactly. to do quality. And I've been using that as an example for many teams going, well, there's so much on, there's all these platforms. You're not obligated to do every platform, but the platforms you do, you want to do really well. And it's one of the biggest takeaways of the stuff that you guys have been doing over the years. You mentioned VR and AR. It's something that all sports marketers are, you know, keeping an eye on. The MLS recently, their cup final, the Fox Sports broadcast that in VR, so you could watch it with the headsets. Is it something that you're one looking at, seeing how you can fit into the puzzle, knowing that it, you know, it might be 18 months or 2 years away before it becomes a fully functional piece that people need to be providing?
Yeah, we're looking at it very closely, and when the opportunity comes, you know, we'll definitely take it. There's still a slight concern over the kind of social element of VR, because if you're at sports, you want your friends with you, you want to experience it with your friends. But in terms of an experience, an immersive experience, you know, we talked about international. We have a global fan base. We have a digital audience of 60 million, and it's growing all the time. Most of those people will never get anywhere close to Emirates Stadium. So to be able to put them there, let them walk out of the tunnel, sit in the manager's seat, have a kick around with the player, you know, that's so exciting.
Well, and that's the thing. It, you know, VR might just end up being put a headset on and it's like you're sitting in the right corner at Emirates and you could watch the whole game. But, you know, we don't know yet whether that's how people are going to want to watch and consume a game. But that's sort of the pipe dream of VR, the classic, you know, we can sell the 50-yard line Super Bowl ticket 100,000 times because people want to feel like they're in the crowd. That sort of becomes more of a rights sales issue than a club issue, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And for now, it feels like VR is going to be short bursts only. You know, to get it beyond that into that live experience, that's going to be very interesting.
And at the moment, the entree for VR is the Facebook 360 type of views. Have you played around with that either in a video form or sharing some of that imagery to sort of feel like what it's like to be there?
We've got some of the kit, but we're kind of looking for the right opportunity to use it well. I think we've done this a lot over the years where we've just thought that doesn't quite feel right. And I think watch this space. It won't be too long.
Oh, very good. Very good. Well, I want to finish off with my closing five, just to get a little bit more info from you. Do you remember the first sports event you ever attended?
I think I do, yeah. I'm an Arsenal fan, which obviously helps with the job. And it was back in 1983. I just turned 8. Arsenal, I have to say, were pretty poor back then. And I think my dad and my granddad and great granddad, all Arsenal fans. So my dad was kind of under a lot of pressure to like condition me, I think, as an Arsenal fan. So he took me there as early as he could. So I had the kit and everything else. And it was September, October 83, and it was the debut of a guy called Tony Adams, which I'm sure you've heard of. He scored an own goal. He gave away a penalty. We lost at home to Sunderland. My dad must have been crestfallen, thinking I wasn't going to support Arsenal after that. But Tony Adams went on to be the only man to captain any team to league titles in 3 decades. So a nice life lesson there for everyone. But that was the first game. So it was, I remember the swearing. I remember the smell of hot dogs and onions and burgers. and I don't remember much else. But my dad put me down right at the front of the standing terrace, as it was back then. I stood on a little box and looked over the front, and he went up the back and stood with his mates. Not quite the way you experience football as a kid these days.
No, but fond memories all the same.
Oh, yeah, wonderful, yeah. And, you know, it did the trick. Arsenal weren't very good, but I stuck with them and I've been rewarded.
Yep. You did speak about hot dogs and onions then. Do you have a favourite food that you like having at a sports event?
Well, Sean, I'm quite lucky that I get to eat in the media lounge at the Emirates for home games. So I'm going to say that because that's pretty decent. I've got a bit of a bugbear about food at football stadiums or just sports stadiums. It's just not good enough for me. I'm sorry. It's expensive and not quite good enough. So I'm the guy who will find the good barbecue joint about a mile from the stadium and then walk down to the ground. So, yeah, if the food gets better, I'll eat more inside the stadium.
That's very good. What's the first app you open in the morning?
It's probably WhatsApp, just to catch up with friends. I say New York Times and Guardian for some news. And although it gets kind of stick and we're moving resources towards other channels, Twitter still for that news hit in the morning is still the first one I go to. That could change. But I mean, what do you feel about that? Do you still go there early, even though it's not maybe the future?
I probably go to Facebook first because it seems to get the news feed for me right early, and it sort of catches up on things. And then I would probably go to Twitter second, but probably more just to check on mentions and things like that, more so than what's breaking. But you know, the news feed, you know, for as much as it's a pain potentially for page owners, it actually gets it pretty close to right. Like I open it up and there's three or four articles that I should be reading that are right up there in the top of the feed. So that's normally what I open up first when I get going. Is there someone you think the Sports Geek podcast listeners should follow, whether they be a good follow on Twitter or a blog or a writer or something?
That's a good one. You know what's hard in this job, I'm sure you'd agree, is it's staying across all this stuff. You know, you get inspired by so many people, so many brands, so many teams, so much in the way of technology. But taking that step back and having the time to actually go, yeah, I can follow that person. That's one of the big challenges. You find that as well?
I do. But do you have a go to person that you say I'm going to at least make sure I follow them on what they do?
Yeah, in terms of the job, I say I always say MBA. I think they're always pioneers, always innovators, and I love the tone. You know, we've been inspired by them, and will continue to be so. The Bundesliga, the German sides, are really good on Twitter. We find that they really have that fandom thing down pat. So the likes of Borussia Dortmund, Mönchengladbach, Bayern Munich, as well. NFL really good on Snapchat, and I've got kids aged at the moment, 10 and 8. I just ask them who they follow as well, because you've got to stay across that stuff as well.
Any suggestions about space?
Kids, make sure you ask them who they follow.
Yes, yeah, it is very much the case. So if there was if you had to pick a most valuable player from the social media platforms, which one would it be?
The obvious answer is Facebook, because the sheer scope of the platform. And I think also we talk about international. I think the geo-targeting capacity, which is a really big thing for us. I think Facebook would be the MVP. But then again, in terms of innovation and reaching that young demographic, then it's a close second, Snapchat.
Okay, I'll give you that. You've given it good enough. Normally, I try to force people to come back with one decision, but you've made a good case for both.
Ask me again in 2 years.
Yeah, exactly. We can go from there. Where can people find you on the internet, potentially send you a message or say they've been listening?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Chris Harris 1975, which gives my age away. That's the best place to find me. And you can find me on LinkedIn as well.
Yep, I will share your LinkedIn in the show notes. But Chris Harris 1975, and you are in the sports biz Slack, we've just got to give you a bit of a nudge to get a little bit more active and share a little bit of the stuff that you are doing in Arsenal. But you are in there. But that's fine. We might do a bit of a Q&A in the sports biz Slack once this podcast comes out. Thank you very much. I hope we can catch up next year when you're in Sydney. You're going to make the trip to when Arsenal comes to Sydney, Australia.
I'll definitely be there. Tickets still available for both those games in Sydney. That should be a great time.
Yeah, so hopefully I'll meet you then, or if I'm not in England before then. But thank you very much for coming to the podcast.
Sean, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
No worries, mate.
Sign up for Sports Geek News at sportsgeekhq.com/signup now.
Thanks again to Chris. You can give him a follow on Twitter. Not overly active on the Twitter, but he will see the messages. Chris Harris, 1975, you'll find him on Twitter. And as he said in the interview, he's going to get a bit more active in the Sports Biz Slack. You can find him in Slack, Chris Harris _Arsenal. Question for the podcast, what's your focus for 2017? You know, we're midway through January now. I'll give you a few of mine for both the focus of mine, but mainly my clients, sort of putting my consultant point of view on. The main focus is going to be better commercialization of digital. In brackets, has been the same goal for 3 years running. And that doesn't mean we've been unsuccessful in the last 3 years. It's just that there's still so much upside. And I think there's a lot of movement away from branded entertainment. I think that's still a staple for sport, so putting a sponsor on content and getting their name out there. I really do think the opportunity for sport is to better deliver campaigns for clients and really take that agency point of view from a sports team. So rather than let the agencies take the digital activations, all the cool stuff, we are now at a point where most teams, most sports organisations have the capacity to deliver the cool activations. And so they should be sold in that manner, both in what the return is for the sponsor, but also in the costs needed to build out that activation. So if you really want more on that philosophy and how I'm going about doing that, it was really a big part of my Money in Sport presentation last year. You can download that as a Sports Geek listener. I'm happy for you to download that that presentation. Simply go to sportsgeekhq.com/moneyinsport. Download it. I'd love your feedback. And if you're running a digital department and having trouble monetizing it or having trouble with your relationship with the commercial side of the business, please give me a call. I'm happy to talk about it and see how I can help. One more thing before I go. I'm giving this another plug because it worked last time. Laura is starting to do some stuff, so I'm going to give it another go. And if you are looking to... I'm opening up the Sports Geek Intern Program again. So if you are in university, studying, want to break into the world of sports, and you're passionate about making digital work for sports business, if you love listening to podcasts, and the reason I'm advertising on a podcast is because I want people who listen to podcasts, not just mine, but multiple. And if you've got the ability to write and do ebooks and things like that, please sign up. I'm more than happy to make intros around the sports business world and raise your profile a little bit. To apply, go to sportsgeekhq.com/intern. If you're a listener and you're well and truly entrenched and not applicable to be an intern at Sports Geek, please pass it on to people you think should be an intern at Sports Geek. So that's sportsgeekhq.com/intern. I'm going to push that a little bit more wider, but I do want to really tap on you, the podcast listener faithful, first, get your response. So if you could pass that on to people who you think should be an intern, please do. Until next episode, my name is Sean Callanan. You can contact me either at Sean Callanan on the Twitter, on Slack. I'm on LinkedIn, or you can do the old-fashioned way. You can send me an email, sean@sportsgeekhq.com will get me. But until next episode, thank you for listening. My name is Sean Cullinan, and you've been listening to the Sports Geek Podcast.
Like the Sports Geek Podcast? Find us on facebook.com/sportsgeek. Check out which teams work with Sports Geek at sportsgeekhq.com/clients. Please leave a review on iTunes. Go to sportsgeekhq.com/iTunes. Thanks for listening to the Sports Geek Podcast.